goodness, the wild swings in the stock market in the past couple weeks sure grabbed headlines, certainly caught our attention. Historic volatility shook Wall Street last week as investors worried about inflation, the future of interest rates. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and it's high time to regroup with On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Kevin, welcome back.
Hello, Kate.
And if you have a money question that is on your mind, you can run it by Kevin, 800-642-1234. You can send that question by email to onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Well, over the last few weeks, Kevin, unless you've been under a rock, investors have been pretty surprised to find that stocks and bond prices can actually decline. It's been a pretty bumpy ride. What gives?
Yeah, it's the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which isn't a perfect proxy of the stock market. It's only 30 large, generally United States-focused companies. It's currently around 24,000 or so. Years,
it's made about 200% over the last year. In 2017, it's up about 20%, and in January 26, it hit an all-time high of 26,616. But by February 12th, it had fallen to 24,600. That decline of 7.5% in about 2 weeks really marks the first correction that the United States stock market has experienced in the last 2 years.
So what were the causes of this decline? What do we know?
Well, you know, everyone has an opinion as to why this happened, and no one predicted it. And if they did, you know, it was part of a fire hose of predictions they made, and then one finally comes true. But some of it might be due to program trading. These are funds that buy when stocks are going up, and then they sell when they come down. And that exacerbates the moves more when things are going well or when things are going poorly. It might have been a few small funds who tend to kind of hedge themselves and against declines. And again, when the declines start to happen, they start selling more, and that, of course, exacerbates the situation. And these funds have become more prominent in the last couple of years. And again, when things are going well, those generally kind of set fire to the situation. But when things are going poorly, that triggers more selling on. What's really the bigger move behind this, in my opinion, is higher interest rates, somewhat in the form of inflation. We've seen a little bit of uptick in the inflation, but we have low unemployment right now. We really haven't seen higher wages for workers, and that's something that is not only good for the economy, but it can lead to higher inflation. But the biggest issue might be the fact that with the recent tax cut plan, the government might have to borrow up to $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion more. That generally means higher interest rates above and beyond, and that's led to a decline in bond prices and mutual funds, and it makes bonds more attractive to people who otherwise wouldn't be investing in them because the interest rates were so low.
Well, I heard a lot of conversation around market correction. Is this the beginning of a bigger decline?
You know, it certainly could be, and it wouldn't be surprising with the way things have gone. If you go back, you know, even a little less than 10 years back to March of 2009, when the Dow was around 7,000 or so. So we're really up almost 300% since that low. So it certainly wouldn't surprise anybody if stocks didn't do as well in the next few years as they have in the last 10 years. But more likely, this is just a return to normal where prices do fall. And more importantly, there's more volatility. The percentage moves in the stock market have been relatively high in the last few weeks, where you might have a 0.5% or a percent gain or loss in a given day. And from one day to the next, that doesn't seem to have any relation to the previous day's action. And because the index, in the terms of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, is so high now, a 0.5% or a 1% move can sound like a huge decline to people who haven't been tracking it recently. You know, 1% decline in a 26,000-point index is a 260-point drop. More importantly, this is a healthy warning to people who are invested in the stock market and do think that all you do is you just put the money in and you wait and then you've got more money. It's a notification and a red flag that prices do drop, you can lose money, and worse yet, they can not only go down, but they can stay down for a long time.
Well, Kevin, what's your advice? What would you suggest investors do right now?
Stop looking at the headlines and the indexes for a second and take a look at your own personal situation and figure out why your money is invested where it is. If you do need it soon, you probably don't want to be in the stock market. You should be more conservative with it, even if you are planning on only using it gradually over time. If you're saving for retirement, though, keep saving. Except declines are going to happen in stock mutual funds. You could easily lose 10, 20, or 30% in a bad year. And bad years do happen every few years. And it can have two or three bad years in a row after two or three good years. That's the price that you have to pay for getting the superior long-term rates of return that we hope to get from stock market mutual fund investing. You have to understand that if you're going to drive 80 miles an hour in the passing lane out on the freeway, you have a chance of getting a ticket. You're more likely to get an accident. And when things do go wrong, it makes it much worse than if you're driving 65 or 70 in the right side lane. And finally, you need to evaluate your need for return versus your fear of risk. Some people, when they're retiring, based on their spending and what they've been able to accumulate over the last several years or several decades and Social Security, they realize, oh, I actually have enough money to retire comfortably, even if I don't make a lot of it. Therefore, why am I risking this money and risking a 20 or 30% decline? One thing that happens, Kate, during declines is if someone says, let's say they just have $100,000 in their 401k at work, and it's all invested in stock funds, and it drops 30%. Mm-hmm. Those people never say, well, good, I still have $70,000. They say, oh my gosh, I lost $30,000. And so you have to...
Now, glass is always half full, Kevin.
Yeah, or half empty, depending on if it's your money or not. And the bigger concern I have right now in this investing environment is bond mutual funds. Because, again, when interest rates rise, most bond mutual funds tend to fall in price. And because they pay so little, there is a much higher chance for risk here than there is for reward. And according to Morningstar, their long government bond mutual fund, which is the kind most people would choose if they were picking different categories in their 401k or their 403b, that's down 6.2% so far just this year, just in the past few weeks. And it was only paying about 2.5% to begin with. So those people have lost almost 3 years' worth of interest by being in that particular bond fund.
Well, it's been a couple weeks since you were last on with us, and you have a couple updates to share on some recent developments.
Yeah. First of all, this one is very exciting for me. We now have an On Your Money podcast. A lot of people have been asking for this. They've said, I can't listen to the show every single time it's on live, and it's tough for me to navigate to get it on the WPR.org website. Now you can just go to iTunes, search for On Your Money, and then you can subscribe to the podcast. It'll load automatically, and there are several months' worth of the previous episodes that are in there as well if you miss something and you want to go back and get it. Second of all, this week I'm going to be in Madison at the Capitol, and I'm still not sure this is correct, but I'm getting a legacy award from the Governor's Council on Financial Literacy, and there are 17 other people and organizations besides me getting these kinds of awards. They do give them out every year, but I'm really proud of this, not because of something that I've done, but because of this organization. This is the Governor's Council of Financial Literacy has been around for decades. And it made Wisconsin, along with the Department of Financial Institutions that sponsors this this entity, it's made Wisconsin, in my opinion, the leader in educating its citizens on financial literacy, not just students, but also adults, and trying to get everyone as smart as they possibly can about money and making sure that they're doing the right things for themselves. And so I'm very excited about that.
Congratulations.
And finally, oh, thank you, Kate. Finally, next week is our WPR membership drive, and we, of course, are going to have a special show for On Your Money. We're going to be offering the On Your Money Mini Money Booklet, covering college costs to help everyone who's worried about paying for the rising cost of higher education, whether you're a prospective parent or you're someone who's fresh out of grad school with a bunch of student loans. We are going to be giving information away in covering college costs that you can use, and you can get that On Your Money Mini Money Booklet by pledging any dollar amount during next Tuesday's show.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. You can join On Your Money. There's a line for you for your personal finance question, 800-642-1234. What pressing money question do you want to run by Kevin? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email onyourmoney@wpr.org. Post your question to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kevin, a listener named Ian says, love your insightful, tailored, and sensible advice. Ian says, I'm recently retired thanks to a pension. I don't need huge returns on investments. All of my retirement account is in stable value fund earning, about 3%. I feel like I missed the bus on the stock market has soared without me. Now I'm worried a bit about inflation. Should I transfer some money to the market now or stay the course? Count my blessings.
Yeah, I'm guessing that this email was probably sent in before the last couple of weeks, because not only did Ian miss the bus of the stock market, but he missed getting hit by the bus or thrown under the bus during the last couple of weeks of activity. The stable value account to which he is referring is generally only available in 401k, 403b, and 457 retirement plans, the ones that people usually have through their at-work retirement plan. And how it works is the money that you deposit into that stable value account, the insurance company or mutual fund company that runs the stable value account invests that, and they attempt to give you a fixed rate of return, what they think is a sustainable rate of return based on all of the interest and any gains they might get from investing the money. It is safer than a bond fund because generally they try to keep the value stable and then pay you that same fixed rate of return. But the problem with the stable value funds is that a lot of people, because they hear insured or insurance, they think it's FDIC insured. It's not. It's only as good as the claims paying ability of the company offering it. And even then, there are a lot of things within the fund that can cause you to lose money, that can cause the money to be locked up for a certain period of time where you can't get it out, and they can't tell you when it will come out or how much you'll get out when it comes out. So it's not as safe as a CD, but it's probably safer and more predictable than a bond fund.
So should Ian move some money out of that account and into the stock market?
Today, I would say probably not, for a couple of reasons. One of which, again, we're a lot closer to the all-time high than we are to the all-time lows in the stock market, so there might be more risk going forward than reward. Second of all, if he has a pension, that pension is already invested in the stock market, at least a portion of it. Mm. And so he's experienced some exposure to the stock market, whether he likes it or not. And when the stock market has gone up, that pension has probably been made stronger, but the reverse can happen. If investments decline, so will the strength of that pension account. And that's bad enough. But the worst thing is that when you have a pension from any entity, you not only have no knowledge over where that money is invested at a given moment, you don't have any control over it. You can't call up the pension administrators and say, hey, I'm retired. I'm getting more conservative. Can you make my pension, my tiny slice of that money a little bit more conservative? And so if I'm wrong, his pension will stay strong and be better off. But I'm right, he'll be glad he preserved a portion of his retirement account.
Well, what about this notion of trying to beat inflation?
Yeah, I have troubles with that too, in part because inflation is very low right now. It doesn't seem like it, because a lot of the things that we purchase on a regular basis seem to be rising in price constantly, and you know, whether it's milk or gasoline or apples or what have you. But mostly general expenditures are relatively low, in the 2-3% range. And people who retire, we're going to be talking about this in a few weeks, retirees usually don't spend much more in retirement in real dollars or in inflated dollars than they did when they were working. Usually, as we start to slow down a little bit, we just don't spend as much going out or traveling. They do in the first few years, but not as much after the second or third year of retirement. And therefore, I've seen this, you know, I've done this for 30 years now. We've actually escorted people from their 60s to their 80s in retirement. And I've seen their spending every single year. And generally, their spending does not go up every single year. And finally, there's a there's a notion that people like to make, say, 3% because they want to beat inflation. And 3% is probably what Ian's getting on his stable value account. But in this example, let's say you have two investment choices, choice A and choice B, and you have a five-year time frame. Portfolio A just pays you 3% per year. Every single year, you're going to get 3%. But portfolio B will pay you 10% per year in four out of the 5 years. But in one of those years, you're going to lose 20%. So you get 10% per year in four out of the 5 years. But one of those years, you're going to lose 20%. Most people would take portfolio B and say, I will accept that decline for those four great years. But when you run the numbers on it, you find that portfolio A makes you 3% and portfolio B only makes you 3.2%, even though you've made 10% in four out of the 5 years. And most people, when confronted with that, say, oh, maybe I am better off just kind of taking a little bit at a time, being the ant rather than the grasshopper, being the tortoise rather than the hare.
You're with us on this installment of On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. You can bring your pressing money question at 800-642-1234. Email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back in just a moment for more insights on your pocketbook here on the Ideas Network. To be a millionaire, save, 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 Kevin Witalis, and keep on boosting your income. That will help for sure. You're with us on this edition of On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. You can join in with your personal finance question for Kevin at 800-642-1234. Email your money question to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Stephen now, who has a question. Stephen from Wauwatosa. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking the call. Kate, I love what you're doing. And Kevin, congratulations on your award.
Thank you, Stephen.
You covered all the bases.
I did. So I've listened long enough. I know. So I have a 401k rollover that is currently sitting in cash. I had intended last week to purchase a Vanguard ETF S&P index fund, but didn't pull the trigger, and now I'm glad. But I'm wondering, with all the volatility, is it better? I know market timing is tough, but is it better to hold off, or should I go ahead and pull the trigger and put it in that index fund today?
Well, let's start with I like the index fund. I like low-cost investing wherever it's possible, but to trying to reduce expenses, and Vanguard and index funds and exchange-traded funds, which you mentioned, are usually all very low-cost ways to invest, meaning their internal expenses are extremely low. It's kind of like buying generic sugar versus name-brand sugar. But in terms of timing for it, I have no idea, Stephen. Nobody does. Anyone who tells you they do is lying. And so all you can do is say, why am I putting this money to work? Do I want to earn a higher return? Okay, that's a reason to put it to work now. Do I need to earn a higher rate of return? I can't know that without knowing your exact financial situation. And more importantly, can you handle this? If you put $10,000 into this, Stephen, how are you going to feel if at the end of this year, for example, that $10,000 has dropped down to $7,000. Can you handle that? Or are you going to say, oh my gosh, that would kill me if I went through that? Then you probably, no time is a good time to invest in the stock market, because that can happen at any time. And especially, again, after a time where we've had all-time highs in almost all different kinds of investments, we are in a bubble in many different kinds of investments. That doesn't mean this is the beginning of a big decline necessarily. It just means that the risk is extremely high right now relative to the reward offered. And when everyone is talking about how awesome their portfolio did, that's usually not a good time to put money in the stock market. When they're bemoaning it and saying, oh my gosh, I've lost so much money, I'm never going to be in stocks again, that's usually the best time to put it to work.
Stephen, good luck. Thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Jared now, who joins us from Northeast Wisconsin. Hi, Jared.
Hi, good morning, and thanks in advance for taking my call. Looking to reduce my taxes from 2017. It looks like I'm going to owe some, and so I'm looking for an IRA. And I've got a two-part question. One is it a one-to-one ratio, meaning if I invest $5,000 in my IRA, will I see the amount owed in taxes reduced by $5,000? And the second part is, what are two or three things I should be looking for as I shop around for different IRAs?
Yeah, that's a good question, Jared, and now's the time to do that because you've got about 2 months before the deadline of filing your taxes and making any contributions to IRAs or Roth IRAs. My first question for you, Jared, is if you're eligible for an IRA. You had earned income, I take it, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And did you, your job, do they offer like a 401k or 403b there that you participated in?
They did, although I left that particular job, and so I stopped contributing in about August.
Okay. Depending on your income, you may not be eligible to make a tax-deductible IRA contribution, but I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that you probably are. And if that's the case, then you can put in your earnings or $5,500, whichever is less. And if you're over 50, you can put in $6,500 or your earnings, whichever is less. Let's use an example of $5,000 to demonstrate the tax savings on it. Let's say you made $50,000 last year, and then you put $5,000 into a tax-deductible IRA. The state and federal government will now tax you like you made $45,000, even though you actually earned $50,000, because you take $5,000 out of your taxable income when you make a tax-deductible contribution to the IRA. That doesn't save you one for one in taxes. It saves you taxes probably in the 15 to maybe 20% range for most middle-income workers. So if you put $5,000 into an IRA, a tax-deductible one, and then it you were in the 20% overall federal income and state income tax bracket, let's say, you'd save about $1,000 on your tax bill in the subsequent April 15th. So it's a pretty good deal. You also have any earnings sheltered from taxation while the money remains in the IRA. But then finally, you will pay taxes on that when you pull it out in retirement. And if you need to get at the money early, you'll not only pay taxes on it, but you could get hit with a penalty if it's before 59 and a half as well. And when you're shopping around for it, many of the online providers like Vanguard, Schwab, Fidelity, TD Ameritrade are very scaled down so that they can handle relatively smaller transactions like this online. You can transfer the money from your bank account directly there. In some cases, they can get you a human being who can help you, but for $5,000, they don't make a lot of money on you, so it's hard to find a person to help you with it. But I'd go to those, and if you need a person to talk with about it, you can look at, you know, any local investment company might be able to help you. Again, it's tough to find a good one who's willing to just help you start with $5,000, but if you have other assets to invest, they might be able to look at your big picture and decide not only what you should do with this $5,000 or whatever it is for your IRA contribution, but how you should allocate the rest of your funds as well.
Jared, thanks for the call. You're listening to On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is with us, a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. You can join in with your personal finance question for Kevin at 800-642-1234. Email it our way to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. The April tax filing deadline is about 8 weeks away, so we're talking about some money moves to make before that date. What about putting money away for college, Kevin?
Yeah, you can still make contributions to college savings plans to get a small tax break on 2017's taxes. And this is for Wisconsin residents who contribute to Wisconsin's EdVest plan by April 15th of 2018. Make a contribution before that date, and you can lower your state income tax bill by a little bit.
So how big of a tax break are we talking about?
It can be a little tricky. In 2017, the maximum deposit amount that can qualify for a state income tax break for Wisconsin residents in the EdVest plan is $3,140 per beneficiary. In 2018, it jumps up to $3,200. And again, that reduces your Wisconsin state tax on your income. So let's just say you have a 5% state income tax break and you're a Wisconsin resident, and you put in that maximum taxable reduction amount of $3,140. You might get about $150 in savings for each beneficiary. You can open up 10 different accounts if you want. As long as you have a different beneficiary for each one, you get a tax break at the state level for each one of those deposits.
What if the beneficiary doesn't live in Wisconsin?
That's okay, and that's relatively common, especially if we have grandchildren for whom you're putting money aside for college. It still applies regardless of the beneficiary residence, and the proceeds from that EdVest account can be used tax-free at any school for qualified higher education expenses in any state, and there are even accredited schools overseas that you can use tax-free distributions from a 529 account for. And then as of January 1st, you can start using 529 proceeds tax-free for qualified tuition expenses for K-12 private schools.
So for people who are able to, should they contribute more than just the amount that qualifies for the Wisconsin state tax break?
If you're if you've got a lot of time on your hands before the beneficiary might be needing the money and you're a bull on investments, maybe. Because the big benefit here is not so much the state income tax break, it's that the earnings in the future are sheltered from taxation, and then again that you get to pull it out tax-free upon withdrawal. But you need gains, really, to get that benefit. And if you only have a short time frame, like a couple years before your kid goes off to school, you might not want to invest that in the full stock market because, again, you can have a very big decline, which wipes out not only the tax break, but a lot of the money you've accumulated for it. So if you have a long-term investing time frame and you're able to take the risk to get those hopeful higher returns, yes. Otherwise, you might want to just set aside enough to get the state tax break each year, so because then you can at least put aside $3,000 for each beneficiary each year going forward. Whether if you do $15,000 right now and that's all the money you contribute, you're not going to get the state tax break in future years because you're not making any future deposits.
Well, let's bring in another call now. Let's go to Patrick, who's waiting in Madison. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Go ahead.
I'm 57 years old, and my portfolio for my 401k is pretty much 70% in stocks and 30% in bonds. And I'm wondering when I should start. I'm looking at retiring at about 65. And I'm wondering when I should start moving money from the market and into the bonds, which are more safe. And then my bigger question is, you know, I've been told how to put money in, and I've been doing that. But how do we take it out?
Patrick, are you referring to taking it out like today, like to move it to different funds, or actually to live off of it when you turn 65 or whenever you retire?
I mean, when I'm retired, how do I withdraw the money?
Yeah, it depends on the provider. Let's get that one first because that's the most interesting one is how am I going to live off of this money? What happens is either you leave the money in the 401k and the 401k provider allows you some kind of distribution method. And most people prefer like a check every single month or every 2 weeks even that kind of helps replicate the paycheck that they're giving up by retiring. So you get, let's say you figure out that a sustainable amount is $2,000 a month from what you've accumulated in your 401k. You might have $1,000 sent every 2 weeks into your checking account, or you might have $2,000 sent in once a month. Or you can take it out willy-nilly. Just say, hey, I need $5,000. I'm going to take this out, withhold the taxes for me, and just send me this amount. Now, a lot of 401k providers don't allow those kinds of frequent distributions or one-time distributions or whatever. And if that's the case, then you might have to move that over into a qualified IRA with a financial services provider, like an investment firm, an insurance company, a bank. Again, Fidelity, Schwab, Vanguard, all those places are more than happy to help you roll that money over into an IRA. And then you not only get the freedom to invest it really however you want, but then you get to decide when and where and how to take money out of it. And the reason that's especially interesting to me is because you can manipulate your withdrawals, Patrick, so that your income is hopefully lower than it would be if you just took a big chunk out all at once or took more out than you actually needed. Now, back to your original question where you're talking about moving it, it's tough to say because on one hand, you know, you've got 8 years until retirement, and then retirement is usually a 20 or 30-year proposition. So by that definition, you have a very long-term time frame. You can afford some of the risk in the stock market to get a hopefully higher rate of return. But talking about trying to decide when the allocation is, again, one of the things you need to look at is How am I doing? Have I reached my goal? If I don't make anything, will I still have enough to retire on? And if that's the case, it might be a good time to scale back the stock market exposure anyway, because it's very hard to lose money, especially when you are on the cusp of retirement. The bond funds may not be as conservative as you think they are, but they're probably less volatile than the stock funds. And if you have some kind of money market or fixed rate account in that 401k, you might want to consider looking at that as well.
Patrick, thanks for the call. Nancy in Milwaukee has a question that dovetails with Patrick's. Nancy, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. This is I'm sure, going to seem to be very simplistic for you. I'm 86 years old, and I want to take quite a bit of money out of the stock market, but I want it paid to me in the form of a rollover so I don't have to pay taxes on it. And I literally don't know how to do this. Shall I go to a bank and establish a CD into which at the present time there wouldn't be money, but as soon as that check would arrive, not to me, but right to that bank? Is that the way you would do it? I feel I'm at total loss at this. I've been pondering this, and I think based on everything that you've said, this is a time at my age for me to get out of this entirely.
Nancy, okay. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, I don't think that's simplistic or a dumb question at all. I think it's a great question. And you know, a lot of my clients are really smart people, smarter than me. They're doctors or CEOs or professors or whatever. And they ask me a lot dumber questions than that one, Nancy. So don't feel bad about it at all. And that's what I'm here for, both in my grown-up job and on the radio, is to hopefully answer questions that people don't have anywhere else to turn to. Nancy, are you saying this money is in a retirement account right now, like an IRA or some kind of 401k?
Yes, entirely.
Okay. And can you give me this, the type of company that's running the account? Is it like Fidelity or Schwab or Vanguard or somebody?
One of them is Nicholas, and one of them is Fidelity.
Okay. And you're saying you want to just put it in the bank so it's nice and safe, right?
Well, the majority of it.
Okay, I'm perfectly fine with this. And here's what you do. You go to the bank and you tell them what you've done and you want, or what you want to do, and they will help you open up an IRA in your name. And then you'll say, I want to move this money from this other institution over there. And they might say, well, do you want to sell it all there? And if there's going to be no commission or anything like that to do so, I would suggest you just sell it where it's currently at. But then they'll transfer that money, either in kind or in cash, directly to your new IRA at the bank. And then you can put it into like a CD. And I'd suggest you get something that, you know, is in 2 to 5 years. You can probably get close to 2% yield at least on that if you do go that route. But when it comes from the old provider and goes directly to your new IRA, Nancy, there will be no taxation on it on the way over because you never actually took possession of it. And in the bank or the credit union, wherever you're doing this, they should be able to do this and explain it to you in a way that you understand it. And if not, go look for a different bank, because it's actually a pretty common transaction. But again, this is one of the reasons why you work with them, is so they can handle the details rather than you having to go through yourself. It's like when I go to get my oil changed and the mechanic asks me something. I'm completely incompetent when it comes to cars or just about anything mechanical. They ask me something like, well, is, you know, your rear differential shifting? And I don't even know if I have one of those or not. And so your question about can I do this and how should I do this, you should be able to get a good answer from the provider of if you can do it and how you could do it. And if not, go look for a different one.
Nancy, thanks so much. Thanks for the call. You're getting personal finance advice with the help of On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Do you have a question about your personal finances? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. When we come back, we'll talk about the financial side of online dating. Do you have a subscription to an online dating site? Is it worth the price? 800-642-1234. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Love is in the air. yes, love is in the air. As our technology has evolved with smartphones and apps, so has the online dating world. Online dating has been around the block. Back in the mid-90s when Match.com was born, the courtship process was a whole lot slower on the good old desktop computer dial-up connection. We're talking about getting your money's worth from these online dating sites. Kevin McKinley is here, a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. You can join in, too, with your personal finance question. Email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. If you're single and Valentine's Day has you thinking about going online to find that special someone, there are a few things you should do to get the most for your mating money, so to speak. First off, give us some data, Kevin, about who's in the online dating pool these days.
Yeah, this is not just some excuse like my wife found me, you know, on online dating sites, and I said, it's for a segment on the show, honey. That's what it's for. So I really wanted to do this because if you are single, first of all, you are not alone. There are 110 million single American adults, 18 and over. 45% of all adults in the U.S. are single, and 47% of all households are headed by a single person right now. Those are all-time highs. And many of those singles are looking for love online. About 1 out of 5 Americans have said that they have looked for online, and 15% of the U.S. population, give or take, visits a dating site about once a month. And those people are having some success. About a third of marriages in the last 5 years, according to a recent study, have come from people who originally met online.
So what are some of the advantages of using the web to find a prospective mate or date?
For better or for worse, it's the efficiency. You can screen by site, you know, religion, sexual identity, age. AARP has their own dating website right now. There is a website called creditscoredating.com that you can hook up with people who hopefully have good credit scores. And you can, of course, do it by career, by going to places like farmersonly.com. And then once you're in that site, you can screen by different characteristics. You add in your own information and hopefully find matches that that meet up with your criteria. You get more privacy than just wandering up to people at a bar or the supermarket. And you get more anonymity as well, because you can kind of go through things without having to approach them and talk with them directly. And it's only until you find someone you're interested in who's also interested in you until you can strike up a conversation.
Any tips that you can share to have the best possible success?
Yeah, according to the website moneyish.com, you start with your picture. It should be good, but not too good. Don't airbrush the heck out of it and Photoshop, you know, Brad Pitt or someone on your head, guys, because then you're only going to disappoint the person when you eventually meet in person. Men should not wear a hat, they say, and women should be looking directly at the camera. Then your description. You need to have a nice, fun description, but again, not too crazy for it. If you're worried you can't write it well, get help from somebody. There are several websites and services that will look at your dating profile, analyze it, and try to spruce it up a little bit for a little bit of money. Phrases and words that work. For men, the phrase physically fit tends to attract more views and more contacts. And for women, the phrase ambitious was the one that drew better than average responses from men. And for everybody, there's a certain word that you can use that had 144% increase in responses over the average website that did not use this word. Do you have any guesses, Kate, as to what that word might be?
Oh, my goodness, Kevin. Wordsmith, please tell us.
Guacamole. So try to work it in there if you can. If
work
you can,
in the guac.
Work in the guacamole. If you can't, just put guacamole. Just say, hey, and, you know, I'm 6'2", 185 pounds. I'm looking for someone to spend time with. Guacamole.
Lest we digress, this is On Your Money. Kevin, there are a few financial concerns here, I understand.
Yeah, one is the cost of the sites. Many are free to draw people in, but then there are premium services that cost $20 to $40 per month. And those are actually okay, because one of the things that finding a site that does charge it can do is that it eliminates people who are disguising their identity, because they have to pay for it usually by credit card. And so it's a lot tougher to just go on there and say you're someone who you're not if you actually have to provide payment details for it. And then as part of that payment period, one of the biggest financial complaints that people have had about dating sites is continuous billing, where they sign up for some service that, you know, costs $20 a month, and then either they're not happy with it or they find somebody and they want to cancel the service. But the the website doesn't do a great job of stopping deducting the payments either from their credit card or their debit card account. And so make sure you monitor the statements afterwards to ensure that the payments are stopped, taken out, and not getting more unwanted charges.
Anything else to be wary of?
Yeah, you want to protect your privacy and your pocketbook from the other people on the site whom you don't really want to meet or be involved with. Always stay on the platform to communicate. If someone asks you to say, hey, let's not talk here, I'll send you an email directly, or let me text you, give me your number, or worse yet, your home address, don't do that until you're completely sure this is someone you can trust and you're okay giving that information out. Don't disclose any private information out at all. Don't even link to your Facebook page or anything until it's someone you're ready to make some form of commitment to. If you're going to meet, try to meet in a public place rather than having them pick you up at your home. And don't send money to anyone. In 2013, the Internet Crime Complaint Center said $80 million was lost to romance scams. People met someone online and were taken advantage of and sent a bunch of money to them, and then they never got the money back. So be very careful about anyone who you're looking to date who is also going to ask for money. It's usually a sob story, like I'm in my country, I can't get out, or I have health problems or something, and just say, hey, I'm really sorry, I can't help you, and move on to the next swipe.
Well, Kevin, full phone lines here. Let's go back to the phones. Bruce has been waiting in Springbrook. Hi, Bruce.
Yeah, good morning, Kevin. I loved your last segment since my wife is allergic to guacamole, so I have one less thing to be worrying about.
That she could still put that in her dating profile.
So anyway, my reason for calling is I use Treasury Direct, and I inherited a couple hundred thousand worth of double E bonds about 7, 8, 10 years ago. I've been converting those to I bonds, and now I'm putting more and more of that in the tips. I'm also reaching the minimum distribution age. I'm looking to see if there's any drawbacks to that strategy that you can think of, especially with the interest rates going up now. Should I be waiting and for the interest rates to go up more than buying tips, or just keep doing it?
Yeah, tips are it's Treasury, I think it stands for Treasury Inflation Protection Securities. And what those do is ostensibly the interest rate on the bonds is tied to the consumer price index. And if that's going up, the interest rate goes up, and it's down, the interest rate goes down. I don't mind tips. I like Series I savings bonds better. But the problem, Bruce, is that, of course, you're running into, you can only buy $10,000 per person of Series I savings bonds every single year. So I love those, but usually you can't put very much into them. I get your strategy, and I like your strategy about trying to earn some income in anticipation of rising interest rates. Here's what I'd rather have you do instead, is spread that money out in as many different banks as you can stand, especially to make sure that you stay under the $250,000 FDIC insurance limit that is available at every bank or credit union. And go in with and take the longest certificate of deposit out that you can. It's usually 5 years is as long as they'll allow. And make sure that the penalty for early withdrawal is minimal. 6 months or 12 months of interest is usually the most you want to do. And then here's why I like that. It's because you're getting something for your money. You're getting about 2%. But if interest rates rise, if the terms offered by the lender or the bank still hold, you can pull that money back out and lose very little of it. Like I said, 6 months worth of interest maybe, and take it across the street and get a bank that pays 3%. And I think you're going to see that happen in the coming weeks and months and years if interest rates rise. And you're going to see banks and credit unions changing the way that they charge these penalties. They're going to start saying to you, well, we're going to start putting market-based penalties in, meaning that if you pull your money out early, we'll tell you at that time how much you're going to receive. We can't do it now because we don't know what interest rates you're going to, so there's no fixed penalty. So one of the reasons I like you locking up those CDs right now is hopefully with that policy in place, it'll afford you a little bit more protection if interest rates rise and you need to pull it out and go someplace else.
Bruce, thanks for the call. Let's go to Jimmy in Milwaukee. Hi, Jimmy.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a home equity line of credit for $19,000. I took it to pay off high-interest credit cards, and it's valuable at 8.5% for 15 years. I can lock it at 9.25% for 4 years. I was wondering if I should go for that route, or considering that the interest rates might go up, or should I just stay at 8.5 and see what happens?
Jamie, I'm glad you were able to negotiate that, and it's a good thing you called as a lesson to other people. If you are struggling with high-interest credit card debt right now and you are a homeowner, go to your lender, see if you can get a home equity line of credit or home equity loan to pay off those credit cards, and you can get that interest rate down from 15 to 25%. Down into the single digits. It can make a very, very big deal. The only thing I would say to you, Jimmy, and other listeners who are in this situation, if you can, try to avoid then charging the cards back up and getting then, so you're kind of in a double hole. You've got not only the new credit card debt, but also the home equity line of credit debt. Okay, so back to your question. You're going to lock it in for 4 years at 9.25, you said, and then would it fluctuate after that four-year time frame?
It will be renegotiated.
It'll be renegotiated. Okay. And otherwise, the 8.5% that you can get, do you know how often that can change under the current terms over the next 15 years?
It depends on the prime. Whatever the prime is, plus 4%. So the prime right now is at 4.5 plus 4%. That's where they come up with the 8.5.
Okay. And that could actually go down, right, if the prime goes down?
Right. Yes.
Okay. Boy, that's a good question. I'm a bird in the hand versus two in the bush kind of person, Jimmy, and so I like to deal with fixed things, and I'm guessing the payment for that 9.25 probably isn't a whole lot higher than the payment for the 8.5%, right?
Correct.
Okay. I just as soon go with the 9.25, not so much because I think interest rates are going to go up or down, I don't know, but more so because I can say, all right, for the next 4 years, I just have this dollar amount, no matter what happens with interest rates. And I'm guessing if you make a decent payments for it, within 4 years, the balance will be pretty low after that point, regardless of the interest rate. And so therefore, it won't be a very big deal if rates have risen and you do need to renegotiate.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. Let's squeeze in one more call. Carol is with us in Lake Geneva. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Kate. Good morning, Kevin.
Hi, Carol.
This question is about iShares, because our portfolio with a major brokerage house is he's got us in 9 different iShares and then a Vanguard and a WisdomTree. Is he just trying to spread the risk, or it just seems too complicated to me? And yeah. We're close to 2 to 3 years to retirement.
Yeah, there's nothing nefarious going on here. Sometimes, especially when you deal with a large investment firm, usually what happens is the investment policy or asset allocation model can sometimes be determined in the home office and kind of spread out through the distribution system. Sometimes they let their advisors pick their own funds, but other times they just say, hey, pick 12 funds and this is the model allocation. We'll make changes and let you know for it. In some cases, it seems like these firms are trying to make things look like they're really difficult and like they're doing a lot of work by picking 86 different funds or 200 different stocks and bonds. And in fact, most people really only need maybe 6 to 12 funds at the most, because all of those funds already have dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of different securities. So I'm okay with those iShares and with Vanguard and WisdomTree. I've used those different ones myself. They are very low cost. Usually they allow you to, they're an exchange traded fund, so they trade like a stock during the day. You can buy and sell it at your convenience or whenever you want to during the trading day. Versus an open-end mutual fund that can only be bought and sold at the end of the trading day. So, no, I certainly think this is fine. It's more of a question of whether or not the amount of risk that you're taking in those is appropriate for your situation. If it's your only investment, you don't have any cash or CDs or anything, you might want to be a little bit more conservative with it. But otherwise, no, I think from what you've told me, it sounds fine.
Carol, thanks so much. Kevin, what's the website of the week?
We have 3 of them. We'll put links of them at one of the websites. They are iTunes, where you can listen to all kinds of WPR podcasts, but especially the new On Your Money podcast. And onyourmoney.com, that's our website where we put on notes and show and websites we mentioned during the show. And then finally, go to WPR.org. If you haven't been there recently, check it out, because they're doing a lot of work right now to update the online interaction, the content, and everything. So again, iTunes, onyourmoney.com, and WPR.org. We'll put a link to those websites at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And for more words before we go,
spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. On Your Money can be heard on the Ideas Network Tuesday mornings at 8 and rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. This edition of On Your Money was produced by Bill Martins and Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.